This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I could have gone longer, but I don't want to punish the people too much for choosing to listen to the show. My name is Kaveh Hoda. At least I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. I am the host of this little, relatively informal, irreverent, humor-adjacent medical podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about airlines, medicine, what they have in common, what they can learn from each other. We're going to be talking to a pilot in a little bit. But before we do that, I'm going to introduce my co-host for this episode, a good friend of mine, someone who long-time listeners will definitely remember and know, but a lot of you guys don't. It's Raja Jagadeesan. Raja Jagadeesan. Hey, buddy. How are you?
I'm doing great, Kaveh. Thanks for having me on tonight.
Associate Chief of Staff for Education for the VA of Northern California, Associate Professor of UC Davis, a Doctor of Internal Medicine, and most importantly, a good friend of mine. Hi, buddy. It's good to see your face again.
Oh, it's good to be here, Kaveh. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to just see you and talk to you, and I think we have a really interesting topic tonight.
Can I be honest? Your beard has gotten a lot grayer since we last spoke. It is impressively so. Like,
you know, I could put my work, but that's not true. It's my three children. You know this.
I do.
We should have stopped at two.
Oh, you know, I think I did actually read once that and I knew this going into it. I have three kids as well. And I did know this going into it, but they have shown that like peak happiness is at like two kids.
Is that serious?
Yeah. Well, there's like whatever one study showed that. So who knows, you know. But then, like, the happiness went down after that. I'll be honest with you, though. I'm pretty good with it, except for the fact that right now sickness has entered the Hoda household, and I'm basically watching it tear through the family, knowing it's coming to me eventually, and there's nothing I can do about it. Because no matter how many times I wash my hands or anything, the kids will cough directly into my eyeballs. So there's, like, nothing I can do. to stop this infection. It's gonna happen. But other than that, it's pretty rad, man. How's it going over there with the three Jagadeesan boys?
No, it's fantastic. I'm joking around. I love them. I love having three boys running around the house. It's like living in a blender, just constantly things running around all the time. I was talking to one of my ER friends recently, and we knew this year was coming. I mean, we tried to protect our children from viruses for 2.5 years. And now none of them have an immune system prepared for anything. It's just like the largest petri dish ever. It's insane. we knew it was coming.
Can I ask you a question, though? People keep mentioning this sort of like offhandedly, like we're weaker because we haven't gotten sick in so long. I don't really buy that, but I do feel like we just forgot how crappy it is to get sick all the time. I don't miss having colds all the goddamn time. Like, and I've had like 3 non-COVID like viral illnesses in like the span of 6 to 8 weeks since, like, you know, the kids are in school and they're dealing with everything and they're being exposed to stuff and bring it back. I tell you, I'm glad we're in a better place now that this is happening, but I did not miss all the colds and all the viruses and all that shit.
No, you're 100% right. You're 100% right. No, I don't think the human immune system has changed in the last 2.5 years. None of that's happened. No, our first child, I actually kept track because I was a masochist. His first year, he was 1 year old. He was in daycare for the first time. The first winter, I should say the first like 10 months of his daycare, he brought home 14 viral illnesses.
Yeah,
yes, 14. And that was in 10 months. And I caught 10 of them. My wife caught 5 of them, I think, was the numbers. So
yeah,
it was misery. That was just normal. And we forgot about it when everybody started masking up. We forgot that's winter.
And I know that men can handle physical adversity as well as women. This is a known fact. But the whole like man cold versus woman cold, in my household, there is a real distinct difference. Like, and that's not just me whining. Like, I get a cold, stuff is coming out of every hole in my face that is just nasty and gnarly. There's like proof. I have tangible evidence of things that my body's producing. My wife will get the same cold and she'll be like, ooh, this cold is bad. One little cough. It's the worst. It makes me so mad.
See, the problem, Kaveh, is I know you and your wife, and have you considered the possibility she's just a healthier person than you are?
Healthier, better, smarter, tougher person. I'm taller, and that's essentially the only attribute I have.
I don't even have that in my household.
All right, buddy. Well, I'm so glad you're here to join me. I miss you, man. It's good to see you again. I'm glad you're back. We could talk more about how we know each other, and maybe we'll catch up soon. But we do have our guest here, Neil Downey, and I hope I'm saying his name correctly. I will check once we bring him on. Really interesting story. I'm really fascinated to delve into this. Medical background and a pilot. So I think there's no better person to cover the topic we're going to cover today with. So everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back. Back, we have Captain Dr. Mr. Neil Downey. I said your name wrong in the introduction. I'm so sorry about that. Neil, thank you so much for joining Raja and myself. It's nice to meet you.
And you, Kaveh, thanks for having me.
Okay, can we just start with the very basics? Because we live in America and we barely understand our own system here. So we have no concept of how the rest of the world works. You trained in Dublin, and over there, there's a bit of a difference between doctor and mister in terms of surgeons and internal medicine, isn't there? Can you explain that to me?
Yeah, I think it actually goes back to about the 19th century, Kaveh. What happened, if you know, back in the medical history, back before anesthetics started, doctors were physicians. And surgeons were generally actually barbers. And because there was no anesthetics, most surgery was fairly rough and fairly crude. It was sort of mainly things like amputations. And basically, a good surgeon was a fast surgeon because you had no anesthetic to protect you. And the stuff they did was very basic. So that's where the barber's pole comes from. Barbers, as well as cutting hair, used to do surgery. They didn't have any understanding of sepsis back then either. So they would just use the same bandages and wash them out and use them again. So when they were drying them, they used to wrap them around a pole outside their shop, which is where the red and white barber's pole comes from the blood on the bandages. So eventually when anesthetics kicked in and surgery became a bit more sort of upmarket and became a bit more technical, the physicians still looked down their nose at surgeons and said, well, you're not really proper physicians, you're only barber surgeons. And I think the surgeons basically said, that's fine then, we'll not even take the title. So now in the UK and Ireland, when you pass your Fellowship of the Royal College of Surgeons exam, so your FRCS or FRCSI as I have from Dublin, once you get that, you drop your doctor title and revert to being Mr. or Miss. So it's, I think it's basically a bit of medical snobbery really that's been going on for the past 200 years.
That is, I love the pettiness there. I it's a little punk rock and I love it. They're, oh yeah, you don't want to call us doctor? Fuck you, we're Mr.
that's the gist of it.
I think that's fantastic. And man, I'm just going to get this out of the way now, but I got to tell you, man, I love the accent. I love that. Are you from, where are you from, Dublin?
No, I'm from Derry in Northern Ireland.
Northern Ireland, very good. Okay. God, I love the Irish people, man. I got to tell you, when I travel through Ireland, this is an aside, has nothing to do with the show, but I have to say, we were traveling through Europe, my wife and I, and we went through a couple of different places. We had very low expectations for the food and the in Ireland. We were blown away with how great it was. All fresh, farm to table, just delicious. The people were amazing. The sites were beautiful. Trinity College, where you train, gorgeous place. Really, just an amazing, amazing place, Dublin.
Oh, Ireland generally is well worth a visit. My hometown of Derry. I don't know if you watch Netflix at all. There's a TV series which has been fairly big on Netflix the last couple of years now. You talk call it Derry Girls.
Derry Girls.
So that's set in my hometown about the decade after I was at school. And it's some of it's pretty accurate. And I know the final episode sort of linked around the Good Friday Agreement and stuff, which is approaching its 25th anniversary now in the next few weeks. It was very poignant. You probably know Game of Thrones as well. Game of Thrones was filmed quite a lot of it in Northern Ireland. And yeah. When I was based in Belfast, I actually used to fly a lot of the actors in and out because the studios were about a mile from the airport.
Yeah. Oh my God, that's lovely. What a beautiful place. What a beautiful place. Okay.
Well, you'll have to come and visit Northern Ireland, sure.
I will. That's on. It is definitely on my to-do list. All right, we could talk about that all night, but that's...
That's not why we're here.
No. I have a lot of things to talk to you about. We have a lot to talk about.
So yeah. So now, I watched your TED talk. I've been reading your bio, and this is fascinating. So you mentioned the doctor, the mister, but I'll tell you in my preface, I work for the VA. I should say nothing I'm going to say tonight represents my employer or the federal government of the United States. But we have adopted so many things from the airline industry already. Crew resource management is a common thing, both the Department of Defense and the VA, et cetera. We have a lot to learn, in my personal opinion, from how pilots of the airline industry have approached safety. So tell us a little bit more about your story. So you were a doctor, you were a mister. How did you end up as a pilot? And then how did you end up back working in healthcare systems?
Well, basically, Roger, because of the way the training system was structured in the UK and Ireland back in the 90s, they set it up that when you qualified first, you went on and then subspecialized. But to actually become a consultant in Ireland or the UK or an attending on your side of the Atlantic, to do that, you had to get onto a specialized training program. And a simple message was it was like musical chairs. There wasn't enough seats to go around. So a certain number of people were always going to fall between the stools. And fortunately, I fell between the stools. Now, I'd also tried the UK, the States. I was shortlisted in Mass General. So I made the final shortlist there, but didn't make the cut. Tried Australia. I'd been in the cardiac surgery unit in Belfast and was now down in the unit in Dublin. So basically, there weren't enough posts to go around. I wasn't one of the lucky ones who got one. You were then left sort of in a blind alley that you'd now spent quite a few years specialising in what you wanted to do, but now you'd run out of road and you'd know where to go. The following Sunday, Aer Lingus had a half-page ad in one of our national Sunday newspapers here, and I literally just saw the ad and thought, right, let's go. If the ad had been in the previous Sunday, I wouldn't have read it.
Wait, you just became a pilot because you saw it in an ad?
No, basically, I needed a career. I mean, you know yourselves as doctors, we're fairly driven, we're fairly ambitious. I now realize that after 12 years of training, I was now in a blind alley that there just wasn't enough jobs to go around with the best will in the world, that I wasn't going to make any further progress. Cardiac surgery was what I wanted to do. I had spent about 3 years in it by that stage. And basically, I was now in a dead end where I had nowhere left to go. I could have kept doing sort of agency work and 6-month contracts and locums and stuff like that, but like that's not why, how you want to spend the next 30 years of your career. Yeah. So I now needed something that would offer me a career. And the following Sunday, just by pure luck, there was an ad in the Sunday paper that was advertising for airline pilots. It was a cadet program that Aer Lingus had at that stage where they would, they opened applications. There was about 4,500 of us applied. And I was one of the 38 that got in back in 1999. And I even went to the interviews and like they asked me, did you always want to be a pilot? And I thought, no, I can't go in and say I always wanted to be a pilot, but accidentally became a heart surgeon. Like you can't justify that. So I just said, basically, I need a career. This career has run out of road for me. I'm about to turn 30. I think I can learn how to fly an airplane. Give me a chance. And in fairness, they did.
So that's pretty amazing, man. That's pretty
awesome. They actually took on two surgeons in that batch of 38. The other one was an orthopedic surgeon, and we're both still flying.
You think it helped? Do you think that being a doctor, they're like, well, you know, he survived that, he can do this?
Well, I think they realized that when I spoke to the guys that interviewed me afterwards, they said that they knew I was capable of getting through the training program. Said that most of the interview was based around deciding was I going to stay, because they just didn't get the concept that I could have spent 12 years of training and now be in a dead end. In the aviation world, like they don't invest that amount of time and money into you and then let you end up in the dead end. That just doesn't make any sense to them. So I spent most of the hour trying to convince them of that. That's actually the reality of what I was facing. And they spent most of the interview trying to work out, were they going to waste £130,000 training me up?
Yeah.
No, but I pointed out, a lot of the skills we learn in aviation, are very useful in aviation. Like, you know, we're used to working hard. We're used to working under pressure. We're used to making decisions that are sort of critical to life and death and so on. And I sort of explained to them, like, a lot of what I've done in the past, I can transfer over. Now, I actually didn't realize that I was actually going to learn an awful lot in aviation that I could transfer back into healthcare, which is where I ended up then when I set up Framework Health back in 2011.
Oh, no, I think that's a great segue, I think, Niall. So I think, you know, for those of us who work in safety and quality, the idea of crew resource management or just the general kind of precepts are common. But let's just talk for our listeners. Tell us what it was like, the culture of safety when you're in medicine and now you're in the airline industry. What was it like? What was the difference? And how did that lead you back to medicine?
Well, I went into aviation nearly a quarter of a century ago now. And compared to healthcare, the difference in the whole concept of safety was just black and white. In healthcare, basically, it was if you made a mistake, you didn't work hard enough, don't make it again and work harder next time. The whole culture was especially in cardiac surgery, obviously, surgery generally tends to be quite macho. Errors and mistakes weren't sort of looked on favorably, obviously. When I went to aviation, the whole concept sort of went over my head at the start because I think I just didn't understand it. But then as I gradually settled into it, I realized that the basic message is that error is nothing to be ashamed of. We assume in aviation that we're going to make mistakes. And the whole system is then structured around how we actually deal with the mistake. We look for, like you were talking about crew resource management, that's actually quite a small part of our overall safety management system. I think that's the bit that was fed to healthcare about 10 years ago. And in my opinion, it was fed badly. That it was generally brought in by pilots who thought they were speaking to pilots, and they weren't. Doctors and nurses are a very different industry. You work under very different circumstances. You haven't got the luxuries that we have in aviation. Now, there is a huge amount of crossover. So my view is that there's an awful lot of compatibility in the underlying DNA between the two industries, and that if I can manage to get the aviation people and healthcare staff to work together, we can genetically engineer this into healthcare. I think we can make a huge difference to the adverse event rate that happens in medicine worldwide.
Well, I'm sorry, let me take a step back for a second. Can you guys explain what crew resource management is for those of us that don't use that term? What is that? Does that mean you're literally like how you have resources, human resources, like your team that you're working with? What does it mean?
But it goes back basically to the Tenerife disaster in 1977 when two jumbos collided on the runway in Tenerife in fog and killed just under 600 people in one go. So aviation at that stage realized the amount of aviation was increasing and the amount of accidents was increasing. And like aviation realized when the Tenerife was like a wake-up call. I thought, no, we can't keep doing this. People aren't going to stop flying. So they brought NASA on board, they brought the various airlines on board, and they had a conference the following year to decide out what are we going to do about this. And they realized that most of it was coming down to basic human error. And so we brought in, I think at that stage it was called cockpit resource management, because they assumed it was just to do with the pilots. And after a couple of years, they realized, no, this is actually much wider than that. Error happens like across the board. It's not just the pilots that are involved. So then it was widened out to crew resource management. So it's basically the underlying operating philosophy that aviation uses. But to widen the whole thing out, to put it in context first, the first thing we have in aviation is a thing called a just culture. So that means when we make a mistake, we can put our hands up and we know that we're perfectly safe, that we can't be disciplined and we can't be dismissed as long as it was a genuine error. Now, it doesn't cover gross negligence and it doesn't cover deliberate harm or malicious harm. In healthcare, when I was there, I think it's improved a bit, but when I was there, it was name, blame, shame, and retrain. So once we put our hand up, we're now aware that there's an error. In aviation, we then look for what went wrong. So we work on the basis, well, you've been flying for 20 years and you haven't made this mistake before. So what was different today? What happened in the system that tripped you up today? And we dig into the system and find it was there a tripwire, and we try and engineer it back out and if possible, replace it with a safety net. Whereas in healthcare, I find generally it tends to be whoever was the last person they touched the ball gets blamed for it. So it's who went wrong. Whereas in aviation, we focus on what went wrong. And then CRM fits in then as the third sort of leg of the stool, basically. It's our underlying operating philosophy that we use. So it's the simplest definition is that using optimum use of all available resources. Now, it can be crude. Like, say, as a captain, I've got my co-pilot beside me, who's a very useful resource. I've got 8 cabin crew behind me who've been flying maybe 20, 30 years as well. We've got over 300 passengers. Like I say, when I'm flying tomorrow, I'm flying back to Dublin tomorrow night, I can't see the engines of my plane. They're not in my line of vision from where I sit in the cockpit. So passengers can look out the window and see oil dripping out of the engine, and then they can tell the cabin crew and let me know. So we see the passengers as part of the crew. Then widen it out beyond that again. Obviously, we're speaking to air traffic control. We can ask them for information and for help. If I need to contact our operations back in Dublin, we've got a satellite telephone on board, so I can actually lift a telephone and literally ring the chief pilot on his mobile phone and speak to him directly from the cockpit halfway across the Atlantic. So it's a very wide concept of crew.
So let me ask you, I'm hearing two things that it seems the airline industry is doing better, or at least something that we can learn from them in medicine. One, that there is a culture of blame in medicine. And you know, there certainly is, although, you know, we do have our M&M conferences, morbidity, mortality conferences, and in good places and in good institutions, they do encourage people to be open and honest about things without, you know, fear of repercussion, because that's how you learn. And they do encourage that. But you're right, I think that's still there for sure. People are still worried about sharing what went wrong if something did. But then the other thing I'm hearing is that it sounds like there's more of like a flat hierarchy in the airline industry. Like if you're, for example, in the operating room, it's very unlikely, say, a medical student, and this happens sometimes, but usually doesn't. If a medical student who's sort of at the bottom of the rung notices something funny, they're less likely to say it to the attending who's at the top of that food chain. Whereas it sounds like you think in the airline industry, it's a little bit more accessible to reach the person who is at the top of that pyramid. Am I hearing that correctly?
Yeah, you're bang on. It's not actually a flat hierarchy though, because there's still be somebody in charge. Someone still has to be the boss and take control, but it's a very shallow hierarchy. Whereas in healthcare, I think it tends to be quite a steep hierarchy. So our idea is that we still have a chain of command. So if one of the cabin crew notices something unusual, they generally speak to the person above them, who feeds it then to the cabin manager, who's in charge of the cabin crew, who will then feed it into the cockpit to me. But the system's designed that, say, if we're taxiing out and we're about to go onto the runway to take off, if it's like time critical and one of the cabin crew members is like worried that there's something going wrong that will affect the safety of the flight, the most junior cabin crew member can bypass everybody and come straight to me and call me on our intercom system in the cockpit straight away. Now, generally, there is a chain of command, but if necessary, they can bypass that and come to me directly. And before the flight starts, we try to make an effort, if the boarding hasn't started, to actually sort of so walk down the cabin and meet all the crew. Because we find that if there's someone you've seen at your own walk of life, if you've actually met someone, spoken to them before, you're more likely to speak up again than you are to speak up to a complete stranger. So we find then that if you've actually had a really, like, made some sort of connection with someone, if they do find that there's something they're worried about, they will bring it to you. It might turn out that it's not significant at all, but we encourage them to bring anything they're worried about, and then we can deal with it as a team. But no, it's not a totally flat hierarchy, but it's an awful lot flatter than it is in healthcare.
Yeah, so I kind of want to ask you, Niall, about this journey in aviation. So in my, you know, I have a bunch of pilot friends, and we've kind of talked about where pilot culture was, say, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. You had a lot of, say, former, at least in the States, a lot of former World War II pilots, Vietnam War pilots, and they brought this hierarchical viewpoint that was, you know, the pilot is the captain is the god, don't interrupt him. And then, like you said, after the Tenerife disaster, there were other disasters in the 70s. There was United Airlines Flight 173. There was a bunch of things, right? So now you came in the late 90s. You've been in that industry for 25 years. Tell me about kind of what has it been like to see that culture take shape inside the airline industry where, you know, the captain is not a god. Everyone should have a say. And by the way, the captain has to listen or should listen for the safety of everybody. What has that journey been like that you've seen in the airline industry?
It's been very refreshing, Roger, to see that. Now, going back, it wasn't just in the States that that was the situation back in the 70s in the UK. Not so much Ireland, but in the UK, obviously, there was a lot of ex-RAF pilots who were involved in the Second World War as well, who then went into commercial aviation. Now, you had guys who were used to flying. I mean, they'd been flying sort of in the Second World War, maybe in their teens or 20s when they were very young. They were flying sort of single engine airplane or single pilot operations. They had no co-pilots. They had no crew to deal with. They had no experience of that. And then when they joined commercial airlines, I think they basically thought that they were just in a bigger version of their previous plane. And like they weren't good at interacting with crew, which is again just human nature. That's how they were trained. That's what they were used to doing. In aviation, like we tried to sort of change that. Now that's why it's taken a generation to sort of get to the stage. I mean, we're at this about 45 years now. It took about a generation. Now, even when I started, there were still people that were closer to that sort of mindset than there are now. They all gradually retired. So we managed to transform a lot of people. A lot of other people didn't get transformed, but they eventually sort of retired out. Now you've got guys like myself who are some of the older captains, and like we know nothing but like the new modern system of like crew resource management type approaches and philosophy. So I mean, the same in healthcare. It's going to take a generation to change things. Now there has definitely been a start made. There has been progress, but like personally, I think you're a generation behind where we are in aviation. But it's been great to see that in aviation, it took a long time. It didn't happen overnight, and it's still progressing. I mean, we're still not there either. We're still making mistakes. We still have people that think they're God, basically. But I think there's an awful lot less of them now, and they're gradually being replaced by people who sort of can see the benefit of the new system of like the crew resource management type of generation, if you want to call them that. And I think healthcare is starting to change like that. There's some pockets of fantastic work going on, both in Ireland and the UK and across the world and in the States. There's people pushing the idea, like say Peter Pronovost and Atul Gawande on your side of the Atlantic. We've got people on this side like Peter Brennan in the UK. Martin Bromley is an airline pilot whose wife was killed in an adverse event. And he set up the Clinical Human Factors Group over here in the UK. He's been doing fantastic work for the last 15 or so years now. So, I mean, there's definitely been a sea change, but it's like what I've been trying to do is try and transfer the same change we've seen in aviation and apply it to healthcare. So that's what I've spent the last 12 years trying to achieve.
You're the perfect person in a lot of ways to cross that gap. Because, I mean, we can definitely debate how much medical error there is in the United States. But I think we would all agree, if you believe in those, that 2016 BMJ article that came out talking about medical causes being the third.
Yeah, Martin McCauley's article.
Or if you, like myself, think, you know, if you carefully dissect that out and you look at the meta-analysis that came out of Yale in 2020 that shows it wasn't the case, that's much lower. Either way, if it's 1%, it's still too much. And I think it's a lower number than it was initially presented as, but either way, one preventable death is too much. And we should always be working for systems to try and to to fix that. And I think if you can bring those ideas from other places that have been shown to work, and it sounds like it's been shown to work in the airline industry, right? It sounds like CRM or crew resource management has been proven to work. If we can bring in new ideas that can help, I think that's great. And I think it's really wonderful that you're doing that.
Well, if you look, we're trying to say that has it worked in aviation? If you look at the numbers, again, like the turning point for us was the Tenerife disaster in 1977. At that stage, the average number of deaths worldwide in commercial jet aviation was about 3,000. Now, since 1977, the amount of aviation has increased about 15-fold. We're now carrying, like back then, they were carrying about 250 million passengers a year worldwide, or it's passenger movements, it's known as, because the same passenger might travel 5 or 10 times a year. So we talk about passenger movements. It's gone from about 250 million in the 70s to about 4 billion now. Well, certainly before COVID, we're recovered fairly close back to where we started, I think, now. But there's been about a 15-fold increase in the amount of aviation since 1977. So with 3,000 deaths per year then, if we followed that trajectory, we should be expecting maybe 45,000 to 50,000 deaths per year in the, globally in aviation. At the minute now, the number of deaths in commercial jet aviation annually is generally less than 1,000 a year. Now, back in 2017, there actually wasn't a single death worldwide in commercial jet aviation. So if you look at the numbers there, if we should be expecting 45,000 to 50,000 deaths per year now. We're averaging about 1,000. So that's about a 98% improvement. So as I say, what we're doing is not perfect, but it's made a big change. And I think the similar sort of system in healthcare, as you say, there's arguments over what the exact numbers are. Everyone's agreed that whatever the numbers are, they're absolutely horrendous. They're absolutely massive. And most of the research as well shows that aviation type stuff can catch about 70% of those errors. So even if it is smaller than the 300,000 that Marty McCarty sort of found, and again, though, there are studies actually going back about 50 years, and the general consensus are the number of adverse events is about 10% of the number of hospital admissions. And most of the studies show that around about in around 5% of those can cause or contribute to the patient's death. So there's been arguments over, there's actually been more discussion over Marty McCarty's numbers than there has been out of what can we actually do about this, which I think is a big feeling.
You know, I hear what you're saying, but I do think it's important. You look at that Rodwin meta-analysis I mentioned, and it shows that the number of preventable deaths was probably around 22,000 per year, which is not even like the top 10. But it doesn't matter to me. I agree. It's still too high. But the reason I do think it is important to try and bear down on those numbers and give realistic numbers is because I, at least here in the States, and I don't know how it is in overseas, but I feel like that sort of when people use that information, they use it in grifts. They use it to sell some other product. They use it in a pseudoscience way. It's used in this not, hey, we need to fix the system. It's used as you can't trust the system. Trust me instead. Trust what I have to sell you instead. It's not used to say, okay, well, what systems can we change to change how we avoid incidents? It's used in an inappropriate way. So for me, that it is an important point. But I think the thing we agree on, all three of us very clearly, is that any amount of deaths that we can avoid through better systems, we should do everything we can to follow.
So I have some observations, and I'm going to lead to a question. And Niall, I know you've spent time on both sides of the Atlantic, and I kind of want to get your thoughts on culture in general. But so some observations already. I think you hit some really important points right up front, which is the assumption that humans will make errors. This is not an unexpected thing. This is actually how we function as people. Let's just start with as a baseline, which, as you said, is not always in every culture. You also mentioned that it's probably going to take a generation or so. And I totally concur. So full disclosure, I helped start a one-year fellowship in quality improvement, patient safety at my hospital in 2014. And I'm lucky. I work in a system at the VA where we have a large system that is actually focused on quality and patient safety. They've funded 90 of these positions around the country now. And I've seen medical students and residents in the last 10 years who come in with a little different mindset about this than, say, people from 20, 30 years ago. And it's great. But, and this is the thing I want to kind of bring out. It's so hard in the United States to change the culture of safety in many hospitals for a few reasons. And the first thing we got to talk about is malpractice. So people are people, sections, systems, organizations, hospitals are inherently afraid to actually admit that something went wrong, to actually admit that. And it doesn't have to be someone, like you said, it could be something, it could be a process, it could be a transition from this hospital to that hospital. There's so many different things that could happen. Culture is so hard to change because they're constantly afraid we're going to get sued. We're going to get sued. And it's very hard to change that to say, well, we're going to be a blame-free culture. And it's, you could tell employees that, but they don't believe it because they live in a society where they watch people get sued and they watch people have multi-million dollar judgments against them, whether it's justified or not. And I think it has permeated also our larger culture. I think even if you talk to Americans and patients about how do they think about healthcare, there was a survey actually out of the Commonwealth Fund some time ago, and they asked self-reported, they asked patients, do you think that you've been the victim of a mistake or a medical error in the last 2 years? And by far, the number one country that had the highest percentage response was the United States. 34% of people thought they'd been the victim of a medical error. Now, that may or may not be true. But what's interesting to me is that it was so different in the United States compared to every other country that was surveyed, including the UK, by the way. So it tells you that that's not just an inside the hospital culture. There's a societal culture, right, of blame, of who made the mistake. That's the guy. That's who we're going to, and then it leads to everything else, right? The lawsuits and the money, everything else. What are your thoughts on kind of culture in society and culture in the hospital? And what do you think about how to actually have a safety culture? And you've been on both sides of the Atlantic. I mean, give us some thoughts on how to do that.
I think you're completely right, Roger. We do live in a blame society, because I mentioned in my TED talk, if we hope to make progress, as well as doctors accepting that they make mistakes and putting their hand up, the public have to join in as well. They're part of the crew. As I said, we see a crew resource management as being a very broad concept. Patients and families are part of the crew, that they'll have to accept the fact that they're being managed by human beings. And especially since COVID, they're being managed by a lot less human beings, because a lot of them disappeared from the system and haven't come back. Most units I know on my side of the Atlantic, I'm sure yours is the same, they've a lot less staff available than they may have had 5 years ago even, but they're trying to carry a bigger workload. So of course mistakes are going to happen. And I think the public have to join in and be part of the team and accept, well, yeah, mistakes do happen. It doesn't mean that the doctor's not a good doctor or the nurse isn't a good nurse. It shows that they're human beings working in a suboptimal system, which isn't going to change anytime in the near future. So we all need to accept that mistakes will happen, and that we can't have the heads will roll mentality all the time, because if we do, we'll end up, there'll be no heads left, and then there will be no health service. So I think that we all need to invest in the idea that mistakes are, as you say, just part of human nature. If you even look at evolution is designed that errors are sort of built into the evolutionary system. Your brain is about 3% of your body weight, but uses about 25% of the energy. The brain's designed to take shortcuts and heuristics to try and get the best value for money out of the energy available. Part of the downside of that, the upside is it's extremely efficient. The downside is that it causes errors. And unfortunately, now in the 21st century, in our society, and especially in healthcare, the margins are so tight that those errors now tip the balance between life and death. But we do need to accept that error is completely normal. Now, you say that hospitals are terrified to put their hand up. There's actually been a few studies done. I think Johns Hopkins and Mass General have both tried it, that when they made a mistake, they have a policy of open disclosure where they would tell the patient, sorry, no, hands up, we made the mistake. Here's what happened. Here's what we've done about it. And here's what we've done to try and stop it happening again. And a lot of the research that's done out there shows that patients actually don't want to go to court. It's a very long, drawn out, tedious process, which is very long-winded and very, very difficult to get through. Now, I've got friends who are lawyers over here, and they find it very difficult to work through as well. And
there's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
They've now started looking at mediation instead. So a lot of places that have actually sort of brought in a system of holding their hands up have actually found that it's actually reduced the number of lawsuits and reduced the payouts. Because a lot of patients, I mean, patients don't go to the hospital to attack doctors and nurses, and doctors and nurses don't go to work to do a bad day's work. Everyone's trying their best here. And I think when people put their hands up and acknowledge, yes, we made a genuine mistake, the research has shown that most patients accept that. And the amount of litigation actually reduces.
They haven't shown there's that many things that can decrease your likelihood of a lawsuit other than your relationship with the patient and how they look at you and how they like you. And a big part of that is if they feel that the doctor has been upfront with them.
Yeah, if they can trust you.
Yeah, exactly. If they feel like the doctor has been transparent with them. I think there's not that much else that really shows that. Roger, is that what you're thinking? Are you thinking that it's just our culture, we maybe have a more litigious culture that makes it more difficult to have that kind of, for good or bad, honesty or openness or transparency? Do you think that changes it here?
I think the litigiousness is the gasoline. I think, you know, I don't think it's the fact that we can lose it. I think it pours gas on it. I think Niall just pointed out a huge thing. He pointed out two huge things. Number one, imagine if every physician and nurse could hear from a patient's mouth, I understand you're human and everyone makes mistakes. If you knew that before you went to every patient encounter, how would that change your willingness to raise your hand and say, I think something went wrong? And the flip side, which Niall also pointed out, which is he's 100% right. There have been multiple studies that have shown on the other side, when a doctor, an organization, a hospital, whatever, makes a mistake and actually flips the script and says, we're going to do full disclosure and we're going to actually go to that patient and say, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
We know we messed up. This is what we're going to learn from it. This is how we're going to change things. And this is how we're going to make sure that someone else does not suffer what your loved one did. Those two aspects of this are so powerful. And I think those are the things that we need to really think about as people, right? As patients, as providers, as anyone, is that both sides, the person on the other side's human. You know what I mean? And I think that we forget that here sometimes in our, like you said, our culture is driven by other emotions and money and mm-hmm. lawsuits and everything else, right?
All right. This is great, but I have so many things that we need to cover in a short period of time. I want to move on to some new topics. I mean, that alone is such a good topic, Roger. I think it deserves a whole episode, but we do have some questions still to get through, and then some listener questions people have for you as well, Niall. One I have in this process that you went through, as you were going through training to become a pilot and you're flying your first jet with people in it, and maybe even after that, something we talk about in medicine a lot is people have imposter syndrome for years and years. People can still have imposter syndrome, even when they have gray hair like Roger does, filling that beautiful beard. Was it the same for you in being a pilot? Did at what point, if at all, did you lose it? Or are there still times when you're flying a plane and you're like, wow, I'm in the air in a big metal tube carrying hundreds of people miles into the sky? What am I doing? Do you still have imposter syndrome? If not, when did you lose it?
I think maybe I'm too arrogant, Dave, imposter syndrome. The way we're trained is that before we get to fly 300 passengers, we started in little single engine planes, like little Cessnas. I trained in a school in England, in Oxford, but we did quite a bit of the actual flying training in the States. So we were in Phoenix, Arizona, out in Mesa. So you're trained first, like to sort of learn how to fly in a small plane. When we come back then, once we're qualified, we were doing our simulation training. So we train in a simulator where we actually qualify to fly the plane in the simulator. And then the first time you fly it in the real world, you're flying it with a training captain. You do a certain number of flights in with a training captain before they sign you off. So before you think you're actually released into the wild, I think your imposter syndrome has been beaten out of you by that stage, because we don't want imposters up there. We want people who are comfortable and feel that, no, I do belong here. I'm entitled to be flying this airplane. So I'm not sure if there really is an imposter syndrome thing. I mean, obviously, it's a great privilege to be able to do what I'm doing. It's great to be able to sort of take a $250 million jet and fly it across the Atlantic. But I think we're sort of trained that we don't want imposters up there. We want people who are comfortable and happy with the responsibility that goes with that. Now, you start off as a co-pilot. Different companies have different timetables. In my company, Aer Lingus, when I was coming through, it takes about 10 or 12 years before you get the stage of being a captain and taking the full responsibility. So when you were a co-pilot, you were taking responsibility, but the buck stopped with the guy sitting on your left-hand side. Either himself or herself had spent the years working through the system. So when you move across to the left seat, then you're now taking the final ultimate responsibility. But by the time you get there, you've been flying for maybe 10, 12 years.
And along those lines, can you talk to us a little bit about scary situations and how you manage them? Because I think that probably relates to a lot of people in medicine and beyond. Because I can't imagine there is much more extreme situations than the ones that a pilot and, say, a surgeon, both of which you are in.
I think that we tend not to get scared very often because we don't let ourselves get to that point. We're chickens when it comes to that. We don't let ourselves get in the position of being scared. We try and anticipate what's going to scare us, and we go in a different direction. Like if we're coming into summer and there's a thunderstorm, like say I'm in Orlando at the minute. Florida has quite a few thunderstorms. If there's a thunderstorm right over the top of the airport, I would be very scared to fly through it. So I don't. I have enough fuel with me that I hold. If the storm's not passing through fast enough, I'm not going to scare myself by trying to land in it. I go somewhere else. I divert over to Tampa or at the Fort Lauderdale. I go elsewhere. And I think about that before I leave Dublin at all and make sure I have enough fuel to do that. So the main sort of aspect of my job really is to avoid situations where you're going to get scared. If you get to the point where you're scared, that means you've missed the boat, basically. So it doesn't really happen very often.
Well, that's good to hear. I feel like that's something we have in common in medicine. We're all, as doctors, very risk averse. You know, we try to avoid the situation. It's also why we're not, like, you know, when it comes to like business or anything like that, we're not great at it, because we tend to be, or maybe we are, I don't know. Maybe that's a good thing, but we tend to not, you know, like taking risks in general. But that's good to hear, I have to tell you, because, you know, there's people like me who aren't totally comfortable flying. I'm not like a great flyer. I'm like, you know, that line from, what was the Wesley Snipes movie when he was in the plane? Passenger 51. Like, anything that moves faster than me, I want to be in control of it. Like, you can tell me all the statistics and I can understand the safety and how much more dangerous my driving is, and given how much I drive, I can certainly see that. But at the end of the day, it's this emotional thing. Like, we want to see that the pilot is in control. And I'll be honest with you, because I do a lot of procedures, and I do a lot of procedures that scare people, because there's some risk in some of the advanced procedures I do. I kind of approach going in to talk to these patients, and I approach the situation almost as if I'm pretending I'm a pilot on a plane, and I'm saying the things and saying it with the voice that I want to hear from my pilot. I like to present myself in that same way. So, you know, I think we in medicine can learn a lot about the way you guys communicate. I think that in of itself, the mm-hmm. air of calm that you guys, you know, exude, I think that's really important.
But basically, as you say, people are frightened of flying. I mean, you say we tend to be risk averse. We are risk averse, but there are risks involved. The safest way of flying an airplane is never to push it back off the gate. We can't do that. They don't make money that way. So we're risk averse, but we're very careful about the way we manage risk. I mean, we have to take risks. Like yesterday when we took off out of Dublin, I've got a big aluminium tube with 50,000 litres of petrol in it, basically, that I'm going to take down a runway at 150 miles an hour and then fly at 500 miles an hour across the Atlantic. There are risks involved in that. But before we do that, we work out. I mean, the basic premise in aviation, and the same premise I'm trying to teach the healthcare for the last 12 years, is basically where can this go wrong? And then secondly, what's plan B? So say yesterday, before we actually left the office, to even walk down to the airplane, we worked out, right, so how much fuel do we take? I actually took 61,000 litres of fuel yesterday. So we worked out, right, so that means we're going to be taking off at about 220 tonnes. Our maximum landing weight in an Airbus A330 is about 178 tonnes. So if I catch fire when I take off from Dublin, what am I going to do? Mm. So you're going to have to land overweight, because you can't, if you're on fire, you've got no option. Even though we're too heavy to land, we're going to have to land. But then the next question is, well, how long is the runway in Dublin? Can I land 220 tonnes on the runway in Dublin? So before we even left the office, I put the numbers into our computer system and worked out what's the landing distance I will need. What have I got in Dublin, given the weather conditions? Like, is the runway dry? Is it wet? Is it slippy? Is it snowing? And I work out, well, can I actually land in Dublin? Now, when I worked it out, yes, I can. If it turned out I was too heavy for Dublin, the next thing, well, Shannon's 30 minutes down the road. Can I land in Shannon? If I can't, Belfast is about the only other option. If I work out that I'm too heavy to land anywhere, if I catch fire, well, sorry, I'm not leaving the office. We can't go. So, like, there are risks involved, but we tend to sort of project ahead and have an option for every one of those risks. Say, before we entered when we crossed the Atlantic, there's a North Atlantic track system. The knots that all airplanes use when they're crossing the Atlantic in either direction. We travel in corridors. So like yesterday, there was about six corridors, and all traffic heading westbound across the Atlantic yesterday afternoon is in one of those six corridors, and we're all stacked 1,000 feet above each other. So if I have an engine failure on the Atlantic, I'm not going to be able to maintain my altitude because I've only got one engine left. Now, I can still fly the plane perfectly well, but I can't fly to 38,000 feet. I haven't enough power for that. So we then work out, right, well, if I start losing height, there's another guy right below me and a guy below him and a guy below him. So before we even entered the track system yesterday, we say, right, so if we lose an engine, here's how we're going to deal with it. We're going to turn off 40 degrees to the right. We're going to get away from the other airplanes. We're then going to parallel it 5 miles out, because if we go too far, you're going to hit the track system next to you. So we can't do that either. And then once I'm happy I'm between the two tracks, I'm now going to drop down between it till I get out of the track system. So we're constantly projecting ahead of, like, where are the risks? What can happen? What's the worst can happen is here? And how are we going to deal with it? So at all times, like you're saying about, like, do we get frightened? I would be frightened if I didn't have a plan. Mm-hmm. But at all stages, we've worked out, if this goes wrong, I've always got a plan.
Sounds like it's planning, training, preparation, and being able to sort of plan ahead as much as possible. That's excellent.
Well, the same thing's applicable in surgery. A few of my friends obviously are still in surgery. Like after COVID, one of my friends in Belfast, when he was coming back from operating, they hadn't done any of like a lot of their major cases for several months. So he took a concept that I taught him from aviation, that when he came back to work, starting doing the big cases, he operated with another consultant instead of operating with a trainee. Until the two of them were happy that they were both back up to speed. So it's the exact same. I mean, the concepts that we use in aviation, they're perfectly applicable to healthcare. And like, that was one of the examples that he brought across and found it very useful. And after about 10 days, once he was happy, he was comfortable again, then the two guys separated and they just started operating with their trainees again as normal.
I love that idea. I think in medicine, when I think still people like me who do procedures or surgeons who are doing surgeries should still shadow fully trained other people, other doctors as well. I think that you can still learn a lot from that. I think it's good to see how other doctors are doing it, other attendings are doing. I think that's great. All right, a couple more questions for you, because we have a lot over here. Do you ever get bothered by turbulence?
Yeah, sure. Basically, turbulence is just bumpy air. I mean, we don't enjoy turbulence, but the planes are designed to withstand that.
And like we experience it all the time. So I mean, we especially on transatlantic flights, we get turbulence quite regularly. Again, as I was saying, by having a plan B, we tend to plan ahead. So before we leave the office at all, we get weather charts for like a time period, sort of 6 hours before the flight, the time of the flight, about 6 hours after, roughly, to cover the sort of time frame we're going to be using. We can see where the jet streams are on the Atlantic. We can see where the big temperature changes are, which is usually a sign of like turbulent air. So we plan ahead and work out. Again, as I say, before we leave the office, we've got more sort of charts that we can look into. We can work out that if we want a certain margin for the plane to withstand the turbulence, we can work out, well, given the weight we are at any given point, what's the highest level we can climb to? So obviously the higher you go, the tighter your margins become. But the lower you go, the more fuel you burn. So we have to have a compromise between. So before we leave the office at all, we'd have decided, well, it's likely to be bumpy in these points. So this is the height we're going to fly at to accommodate that. And then even with the cabin crew, before we take off at all, we say to them, though, here's the points where it's likely to be bumpy. And they can plan then their meal services and tea and coffee services around that as well, so that people aren't exposed to sort of getting tea or coffee spilled on them. Mm-hmm. So basically, it's uncomfortable, but it's not that big a deal.
Yeah, that's always reassuring to hear.
All right, now I have to ask you, you know, I have three boys that are in the 10 and under crew. We have been following these balloon flying octagon, whatever they are, that have been getting shot down the last couple of weeks. We got to ask you about UFOs. All right. So first,
I know I love this question.
You got to tell. Okay, first, please tell us if you've ever actually seen or experienced a UFO. And if not, just tell us your general thoughts on things that fly through the sky that people don't understand.
First of all, no, I've never seen a UFO. I've never met any little green man or anything either.
They got but to that... him. He's lying to us, Roger. They've got to him already.
Yeah, he's been co-opted. He's been co-opted. I believe it.
I'm part of the problem here.
Yeah.
So, but basically, I think a lot of the things that people see, like I actually saw an interesting video clip on Twitter there last week, and it was basically a flying object which was going across the sky, and then very abruptly did a 180-degree turn and went the other direction, and it looked very impressive. But when you actually saw it from a slightly different angle, it was one jet flying at a 90-degree angle across the contrail of another jet, and because of the relative motion of the two of them, it looked as if one of the objects had turned 180 degrees. I say it was just an optical illusion. So I think when people see things, they do genuinely believe what they saw. But again, one of the things that we look out for in aviation and in healthcare both is like people see what they think they saw, or people see what they expect to see, not necessarily what's actually in front of them. So I think a lot of UFOs are just another symptom of that. Again, we're back to human nature and just normal human error.
Yeah, yeah.
Very well I don't put. Believe any of this. I think Niall's lying. I think there's stuff up. No, I'm kidding.
I mean, his phone did conveniently cut out when he was about to tell us. And
that's
then
right. He was going to tell us the truth. And the Wi-Fi cut out. Somebody
got to him.
So okay. Any thoughts on these flying objects that have been getting shot down over the United States the last week or two?
No, I've no more information on that than you guys have. But I mean, I don't know, are they a new phenomenon? Have they been there all the time and just nobody's been paying attention to them? Or are they suddenly now just sort of politically more important? I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. It is interesting that it's coming up so frequently these days. I don't remember hearing that much about it, but it doesn't mean it hasn't been happening, but it just means now we're hearing about it. Okay, let's get to listener questions, because there are a lot of them, and some of them are quite good. So they cover subjects that I really wanted to talk about anyways. Here's the first one from Steve Jafford, MD Sample, friend of the podcast, at Superman Sings on Twitter. Are passengers really getting more disruptive, or is it just because everyone is videoing all the time now? I think this is a great question, because I feel like in the last couple of years, because of COVID, there are a lot of people out there whose mask of sanity has slowly slipped off of them. And what little like social mannerisms they were able to like control, they no longer can. So it feels like in medicine, you talk to doctors are confronted with angrier patients than ever. You talk to like waitresses and waiters and people in the service industry, it feels like the same. Is it the case in the airlines, or are we just seeing it more because it's clickbait?
Yeah, I think basically, I don't think the amount of disruption has increased, but I think you're right that the visibility of it certainly has, because everybody on board now has a phone and everybody's videoing stuff and posting stuff constantly. So I think we're seeing an awful lot more of it, but I think it might have been just we're seeing what was always there in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. All right, here's one from Tyler Black, MD, another friend of the podcast at Tyler Black 32. What's a myth about being a pilot that everyone seems to know slash ask about that just is not true?
I think one of the ones is that we only work about 5 or 6 hours a day. My family all seem to think I go on holidays every time I go to work. That's definitely a myth. I think that would be the most common one, probably.
Yeah, that sounds about right. All right, here's a multi-parter from Dhruv Bhagavan at Dhruv Bhagavan. He writes multi-parters. This is his thing. Sure. You don't need to. We'll just go through a couple of them.
Right, sure.
He does this just to torture me. I'm gonna ask you the first two. One, work/duty hour and rest restrictions. That's interesting too, and how it parallels to medicine. And two, how is responsibility divided between pilot and co-pilot? I think that's the most interesting part to me.
Sure. Well, to take the hours, first of all, we're restricted in the number of hours we do. I say, when I arrived at work yesterday, in the office first, we're going through all the paperwork, we're looking at weather, we're working out the things I was talking about, like what weight we are, what height we can fly at, how much fuel we're going to need, what happens in an emergency. We then go out to the plane and program a lot of stuff in. So I'm basically at work maybe 2 hours before we actually push back off the gate at all. They're duty hours. Once we actually push back off the gate, then that's flight hours. So there's limits on both. With a limit on both cases, like say when there's two pilots, which we generally have, our maximum limit in a day, it varies according to the time of day and so on, what time we're up at. But generally our maximum would be around about a 14-hour day. That would be our duty time. We've got a daily limit, a weekly limit, a monthly limit, and an annual limit. So we have to be inside all of them at all times. And the idea then that is that we've got a chance to recover and not be fatigued all the time. Now, to compare that to healthcare, you know, when I worked in the National Cardiac Surgery Unit in Dublin, once we were on a 1 in 4 on call. So during the week, that meant you did a 36-hour unbroken shift. When it was your one weekend a month, that meant about a 56 or a 58-hour unbroken shift. And I find it hard to believe that anyone thinks that that's safe. I mean, it's physically impossible to work those sort of hours and still be sort of cognitively tuned in or even have the sort of hand-eye coordination at that stage. So that covers the duty hours and the sort of flight hours. Maximum flight hours actually in the UK, I think it's the same in the States, is 900 hours over the... It's 12-month period. Again, different people count the 12 months in different ways. Some people count from the 1st of January. Some people count on a rolling 12-month basis. But it averages out that you still end up doing maybe a 40, 45-hour week when you total it all up.
Yeah.
So that's from the Irish point of view. Second question. So remind me what it was again, sir?
What are the responsibilities? How are they?
Oh, yeah, responsibilities, pilot and co-pilot. Yeah, basically we've got all planes, all commercial jets are generally two pilot operations. So the two pilots are essentially the same, but one has to be the commander. So say there's times if we're short of co-pilots, we can have two captains flying together. So captains are qualified; they fly from either seat. The co-pilot can only fly from the co-pilot seat, but even when there's two captains, one has to be the commander. So we break it down into pilot flying and pilot not flying, or pilot monitoring as it's known now, so PF and PM. The actual workload is divided up sort of very clearly. So say I can fly with a pilot tomorrow that I've never met before, and we both know exactly what we're meant to do. So the pilot flying has certain responsibilities. They sort of physically sort of put certain inputs into the plane. The pilot monitoring operates the radios, gets other information, supervises the other pilot to make sure he's done what he's meant to be doing or what she's meant to be doing, that they've inputted the information correctly. So there's a constant sort of check and cross-check system. But the bottom line then is that the captain is the person who takes the ultimate responsibility. But you often hear people talking about as if there's only one pilot, and the pilot is the captain. Both of us are pilots. Both of us are very qualified. I can have co-pilots that are maybe 15 years qualified. They're as much a pilot as I'm a pilot, but one has to be a captain. So that's, sure. Actually, you were asking earlier about fallacies, what do people misunderstand with aviation? That's actually probably a more common one. They think, yeah, no, there's the pilot and the other guy. There's actually two pilots.
The pilot and the other guy. All right. There's so many good questions here, but I just don't have time for all of them. So I'm going to just maybe do one or two more. B. Ivana Rasimi stands for Banifshe, just because I know who this person is. How do pilots minimize the risk of VTE, venous thromboembolism, on long flights? Do you guys wear SCDs? Do you guys wear like certain like tight stockings? What do you guys do?
It's very hard to work around that. Generally, I don't think most of us wear compression stockings. I don't. They wouldn't be very comfortable. Like yesterday, say, from Dublin to Orlando was nearly a 9-hour flight. That would be very uncomfortable wearing compression stockings. We try and sort of move your legs about sort of in the seat and try constantly sort of flexing and extending your ankles and try and keep movement that way. You're up every few hours to go to the bathroom maybe, but generally it's quite difficult. We're sitting there for maybe 9 hours at a time and you don't have an awful lot of opportunity to move about, and you can't go walking around the cockpit. You have to be in control of the airplane at all times, so it's difficult to avoid. But I mean, figures wise, I don't see any sort of huge amount of their DVTs or pulmonary emboli amongst the pilot community.
Yeah, that's good to hear. All right, last question. This is from Dr. Judy Melanick, who's in her own right a fantastic author and pathologist. At Dr. Judy Melanick, I'm really interested in how root cause analysis after crashes affects SOPs. I'm assuming that's standard practices in preventing crashes, and how limits to hours and checklists are strictly enforced to prevent human error. I think we've kind of discussed this, but is there any closing thoughts on that topic that you want to leave us with?
Well, I think she's touched on a few very important points there. And I've actually written a book about error that's going to be released in the next couple of months. It should be out hopefully in May and available on Amazon. But when you dig deeper, there's an awful lot more to it than just the root cause analysis. And especially in aviation, it's usually root causes analysis. There's normally at least 6 or 7 different issues that led to the accident. And I know in the UK, they started a medical and accident investigation board a few years ago. And the guy they put in charge of it was the former head of the air accident investigation board, to try and bring a similar sort of concept in. It hasn't really sort of caught on as much as it should have yet. Again, I think it's going to take a generation to get there. But I think the root cause analysis, like we do that even like without an accident. Every airline has a safety reporting system as part of our safety management system structure. So say tomorrow night, if I even have a small incident on the way home to Dublin, I can use our Wi-Fi system. We all have company iPads. I can log on to their safety net system, and there's a drop-down menu where I can feed a certain amount of information in. There's text boxes where I can flesh it out a bit more if I need to, and then hit send, and it'll be in the air safety office while I'm still airborne. So we're constantly sort of looking at even small issues, because small issues tend to accumulate and become big issues, which then lead to crashes. So we try and sort of anticipate that kind of thing before we get as far as airline crashes. But like root cause analysis would be part of it, but be quite a small part of it. Checklists and so on. Again, that's a big difference between aviation and healthcare. I was speaking to a group of intensive care nurses in Belfast Monday. I was teaching a group of them at the minute about our human factors approach, and we were discussing checklists. And the big difference, I think, in aviation is that my checklist is a laminated A4 sheet, which doesn't leave the airplane. Whereas in healthcare, the focus seems to be getting them signed to prove that them actually happened. Now, I think that we're trusting doctors and nurses. They take an awful lot of responsibility. They're looking after some very dangerous drugs. They're doing very important procedures. Like I used to saw chests open. I've got friends who saw skulls open, but they can't be trusted to hand over a piece of information unless they sign to confirm that it happened. Mm. I mean, I think that's nonsense. Checklists are very important, but I don't think the health service has really understood fully how checklists are meant to work. I think that we're still focused too much on the legal requirements of a checklist rather than on the fact that they're actually there as the final safety net to sort of cover me from having a major accident or incident.
I think I would love to read this book when it comes out. It sounds like we are making some changes, I feel like, in the world of medicine. And I do feel like we've adapted this on some levels, but I don't know if it's universal. I think places like the VA may be doing it more than others. And places that I work have installed checklists in surgery, for example, in the ORs. But I feel like it's probably something that could be even more universal than that. And
I was just on the checklist idea, Kevin, sorry to cut across you there, but there was a study published last year in Holland, which again I discussed with the team in Belfast on Monday. It was a pediatric surgery unit, and they took 1,800 cases, and they deliberately introduced 120 errors into the cases to see what the checklist picked them up. And the score rate was 54%. Now, one of my checklists, like when I land in Dublin on Friday morning after flying back across the Atlantic, we do a landing check, and part of the landing check is, are my wheels down? So if we had a 50% score rate, that means we would land half of our airplanes with the wheels up every day. So it's I don't think we'll go down well. So I mean, that's a big mistake, and there's reasons why that happens. And once you actually look into human nature and human cognition and stuff, which is why I've decided to call the book "Oops, Why Things Go Wrong," because that's basically what we've been talking about for the last hour here.
Yeah.
It's, oops. Mm-hmm. Why do things go wrong? And that's the point of the book. And there's very clear explanations as to why they go wrong, like from neuroanatomy, from neurophysiology, and from basic human nature. And that's what the book explores.
I can't wait to read it. Thank you so much for coming on. It was really a pleasure. Where can people find you? Where can people find the book when it's available?
My company is called Framework Health. Now, the idea in aviation, when anything goes wrong with us, we default back into a framework. Now, one of the problems that happens in healthcare and aviation both is the startle reflex, that when something big, if you hear a big bang, you get startled. Again, going back into evolution, you go into your fight or flight response. The amygdala, just in the lower part of your brain, takes over and sort of floods your brain with sort of adrenaline and cortisol and stuff. And basically, you see a tiger running at you don't stand and analyze and think, "Oh, what will I do with this tiger?" You start running. Okay, so the idea is that we've got a framework approach to try and stop us having a startle reflex. So I called the company Framework Health. So the website's frameworkhealth.net. You can get some basic information there. We've got I can be contacted through that. My TED Talk's on that if people want to have a look at it. Other than that, I'm on Twitter quite a bit with at Niall Downey, so NIALLDOWNEY. And I'm on LinkedIn at Niall Downey as well. As regards to the book, Oops, Why Things Go Wrong, that's going to be available on Amazon.com. We're hopefully going to have it out around about the middle of May or early June at the latest. And we should hopefully have pre-orders available on Amazon.com before that. So that'll be available worldwide if anybody wants to buy the book.
Thank you so much. It's really great. Raja, where can people find you? Or do you want people to find you? I don't know.
Not at the moment. I am on Twitter, but I have nothing to push. I just want to say thanks to Niall and thanks, Kaveh. This is it's been a great conversation.
That's good. Thanks, Raja. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was great talking to both of you guys. Thank you for the listener questions. They were really great. If I didn't get to yours, I'm sorry. Put one in next time and let me know I didn't get to it, and I will get to it next time, I promise. Thank you to Nadine for help with production. You guys, great chatting. Find me at Twitter if you like, if that's your thing, at The House of Pod, or just listen to the podcast that you just listened to. Just go ahead and listen to it one more time. Thanks, guys. Bye. I know, it's cutting out again. Shit.
Niall, can you hear us at all? Oh, no. He's not calling us from a plane, is he?
This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a physician or other qualified healthcare provider for your specific healthcare needs or concerns. The opinions expressed on this podcast do not represent the opinions of our employees. Details in the podcast have been changed so that patient identification is not possible. And I'm alive and I want to stay. For the first time I'm on my way. I'm ready for the world. I'm ready for the girl. I'm ready to save. And I'm alive and I want to stay. For the first time I'm on my way. And I'm ready for the world. I'm ready to burn this fire within. Let's begin.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.